from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the Good Atheist Podcast. My name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Dion Barnard.
Today on the show, we're going to reverse roles a little bit because this is actually an interview about me. So if you are fascinated with me, you're going to want to listen to the show. If not, there's tons of other content to go listen to. But this is going to be a long show and it's going to be in the DVD. I'm going to step down now. I'm going to take off the rings. I'm going to let Dion do this thing. All right, Dion, take it away.
I'm Dion Barnard, and tonight I have a special guest on the show, all the way from Calgary, Canada, and his name is Jacob Fortin, spelled Fortin, as in I give you some of my copper for some of your tin, kind of.
I appreciate the fact that you actually took the trouble to pronounce it properly. That is like kudos on you. I was expecting, here comes the tin. No, you reversed it on me. You went, oh, no, I even know how it's pronounced.
Well,
in
there
your
go.
Face.
In your wow. face. Well, good evening, Jacob. Great to have you on our show.
Well, thanks, Dion. Like, for those that are not aware, you're interviewing me because this is going to make it into the Essentials DVD. And I thought, who best than you, who had been listening to my show for quite some time, to ask me some questions, because I can't get even my own fan base to send me fucking questions. I'm useless.
Well, I think they're useless, not you. I think what I'm going to do tonight, Jacob, is throw out some grand questions that gets you chatting, because I think you are a very interesting human. Quite an interesting combination of traits and personalities that I wouldn't say normally go together. So I'd like to dig around there a little bit. There's an element of you that is extremely collaborative and heroic, you know, want to save the world, want to do good things. And there's definitely an element that comes out that's more pedantic and melancholic and maybe almost a bit sad, maybe almost a bit poetic. And I'd like to draw some of that out, find out what's going on under the skull of Jacob Fortin.
It's a mess, but it should be an entertaining show.
It should. So let's start with you, the person. Now, you call your podcast, for the listeners on my show that have never heard your show before, Jacob is the host of a show called The Good Atheist. Well, that implies a few things. It implies that you're good, and it implies that you're an atheist. So let's start with the atheist. Tell me about your atheism, Jacob. What is your life all about? Firstly, were you always an atheist?
I'm trying to go back, and here's the thing. Everybody's got a different way to define belief. Did you believe in primitive childlike religions back in the day? I would say, yeah. I thought maybe there was some grand order and structure, but I was so young that I can't tell you how young I was. My last ditch attempt to give this God thing a shot was unfortunately kind of mercantile, because I basically said, if there is a God, give me a bicycle. Nothing happened except for, you know what? Eventually, I made my desire known, and then my dad got me one. So, yeah, it's better to ask than it is to pray. That's what I learned.
So unlike Gideon, you set out the fleece and nothing came back.
Gideon's test. You know what I love about Gideon? Gideon's the guy that everybody else would frown upon today. He's like, oh my God, he's a doubter. He's got to test his faith all the time, and then God performs parlor magic tricks, and everything's fixed, and you're like, well, this Gideon character's got some pretty weird criteria, but God seems to be playing along here, so I'm like, hey, everybody, if you make him do really lame things, that's what he can do.
Yeah, he does seem to be a bit of a parlor trick kind of a God. I always find it quite incredible that in fact, most of humanity are not unlike Gideon. I think that's very much a human standard. Everybody puts faith on the highest pedestal, but yet everybody wants evidence and miraculous work to have some kind of actual proof. I mean, that's the craziness of the whole thing.
The problem with faith, though, is that it's a kind of multidimensional word. To go back to what I was saying before about having these primitive childlike faiths, these were not really strong. They didn't have any relevance to reality. You know, they were just an invention of a childish mind that thought that maybe if you wished and prayed hard enough or even thought hard enough, you know, use thought powers or something like that, you might have some control over a world that otherwise seems kind of chaotic and random, really.
Jacob, did you ever read the C.S. Lewis series, the Narnia series, the seven books that C.S. Lewis wrote? So, you know, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And
I do remember that when I was a kid, I did have a bit of a fantasy phase, and I think I read one of the books. It may have been a requirement, or been because I did go to a very Catholic elementary school. It would be difficult for me to remember because my memory of my childhood is so foggy, and I know to distrust it instantly because most of them are just things that my parents have put into my head. I mean, obviously, it suffers from their crazy, weird bias, and now, because they're sort of the guardians of my past, I think they're tainting the whole thing. So I'm not going to believe it.
Why I ask is, I mean, we're talking about the hope that Santa or somebody is going to answer our prayers. I always had that fantasy of C.S. Lewis's world of Narnia and walking through my closet. I can't tell you how many times I opened my closet hoping there would be a snowfall and a dryad walking around. Did you ever have a Narnia-type fantasy that you would open your closet and go into another world, or was that not how your brain worked?
No. You know, for me, I just remember as a kid, I was very frustrated. You could look at baby pictures, and I have a fist and a frown on my face. It's just a natural thing about me. I don't know what it is. You know how there are certain kind of ranges of behaviors of human beings? I think that I was always on that melancholic side. It was just ingrained in me. I am the kind of person that even when something amazing happens, I'll look at it and be like, well, you know, it could have been more amazing.
I have certainly noticed that. Funnily enough, several of my friends have that attribute, that sort of personality trait, and I seem fairly attracted to that. But ironically, most people in the world that I know with that trait don't like me much. So I seem to be the opposite of that trait. And I'm quite fascinated in how you get by with that trait. How's it doing for you? How is it to be Jacob Fortan with that kind of, I see how this is not as good as it could be, kind of criticality? Where does it serve you well and where doesn't it serve you well?
Well, it serves me well in one pretty major way is that I push myself, like let's take a look at my artwork or even the podcast itself, where I'm relentlessly dissatisfied with the things that I produce after they're done. I mean, there's no greater torture for me than actually producing this DVD because I have to listen to episodes where I suck. I mean, I put in episodes which were the best of my co-hosts. And when I listen to them, I'm like, that's not the best of me. And that's just what's got to be out there. All right, here we go. More of me being wrong. More of me saying things. I'm like, why did I say this? It's like a chronicle of wrong. And of course, nobody remembers the wrongs. They all remember the right. Like a person who listens to the show, I'm sure some story that I said connected with some person in some way. I mean, I've definitely experienced this editing shows, reading comments from old shows. And I'm like, holy shit. That person put a comment that's like, oh, thanks for the show. It changed my life. What? I hated that show.
Are you surprised when you get those comments?
I'm surprised in the sense that I think naturally I'm such a cynic. I have such a relentless pursuit of perfection that for me, there are certain types of things that I cannot stand. One of them being podcasts. Cannot stand podcasts because so many of them are just cheap as hell and I hate them. And I'm
they
like,
really awesome, sucky podcasts.
And you know, filtering through that, I feel the embarrassment that a person probably doesn't feel when their show sucks. I'm like, I'm sure that there are some people who listen to my show. They're probably like, man, I feel sorry for that guy too. I got to live with a delusion that maybe they're limited in number. But I can't help feeling that way because I feel that way about a lot of content that I just look and say, you either need a producer or you need a meteor to hit your house.
While we're on the topic of right and wrong, because we're kind of touching on that now, I often ask this of my sort of melancholic or cynical type friends who just have that bent and can't seem to help themselves. My question is, as an atheist, where do you think this idea of what is right and what is wrong comes from? Because obviously I'd get a very different answer from a theist, for instance, who might actually be giving me all sorts of fairy tale stories about perfect forms of right and wrong. Why should anything be right or wrong? What defines perfection?
I don't know. You know, my answer is going to sound really weird, but when I think about perfection, there's a few things I think about. I think about bees a lot, and I think about ants. I think about those two things because I can't help but look at those insects and then look at us and see so many similarities on so many different levels that I think that we should just all take a moment and filter out through all of this noise. And I think part of this noise is this idea that we have a greater control over our actions than we do. Like this idea that our prefrontal cortex, which is still pretty fucking tiny, is having as much impact as the rest of your brain, which is where most of the juice is going, emotions, making decisions for you. And When I take a bit of a step back, the reductionist view, and just imagine for a moment that if you looked through the lens of a tree or a mountain where things are moving glacially slow, our existence, we pop in and out. But the things that we leave behind, the structures we build, the things that we strive for, there seems to be some kind of correlation there, some kind of desire. We have a desire to buzz together, to create giant monuments that point upwards. We desire symmetry, the same way that a bee makes fucking hexagonal shapes, which, when you zoom in on fucking molecular bonds, looks exactly like, and you're like, oh, there's a logic to that shape. There's a fucking aesthetic beauty. And when you realize that there is such kind of reductionist things as symmetrical beauty dictated by forces of nature and you're a product of that, then all the things that you like and enjoy are just more complicated versions of those things. You and I are like the perfect mimickers of nature. We've mimicked everything so far. We fly, we swim, we go underwater, we live in caves. We do it all. We live in every single fucking continent, and we want more. We want moon bases and shit like that. We want it all, but I'm saying that desire and instinct, that's bred into us. That is the same desire and instinct that motivates everything else. So it makes you feel both amazed and awed and insignificant, and I think that that's the part I'm left with. That when we have conversations about morality and everything, they're just manifestation of other kinds of forces. The selective forces to make us cooperative, for instance. This is a strong fucking force. It works really well when you cooperate rather than compete. And so well, in fact, that, you know, the invention of oxytocin, serotonin, all of these fucking drugs that basically make you feel all happy-go-lucky, pleasure town. They're all there for reasons that are just, like I said before, reductionist, but still just beautiful and elegant in their complexity.
And would you say that someone like yourself, what gives you the extra passion for it? For instance, you'll have a look at a book or a picture, or you'll listen to a podcast and you'll groan and gnash your teeth and you'll have this huge emotional response and you'll be passionate about how much you dislike the thing that you're listening to, or possibly how much you like it, but probably how much you dislike it. And I'm kind of trying to pinpoint what it is that you base that on. Or do you think it's just something out of your control? It's just how you get. Sometimes you don't even want to feel that way. You just do.
I want to go back to talk about, say, my early childhood. I was talking about frustration being the memory that sticks with me the most. That frustration bore from this desire I had to have the same opportunities other people had, because I come from a really, really poor family, and we lived in the boonies. And I mean, I'm talking parents farming for a while, my dad hunting meat rather than going to the store. I mean, having a dog sled because there's no truck that comes over to plow the snow and what have you. So we're talking pretty basic. And although it has its very rustic charm, and my father is in love with nature. I mean, he lived in that rusticness his whole life. Like, he was a product of that. He was sharing a barrel with his brothers and sisters, one thing of hot water, and depending on your age is when you got to go in. So this is rustic. And there was still some of those elements for much of my childhood as he was trying to climb out of what is the second world, you know? Like, I come very close to that in terms of poverty. And there is still great disparity in Canada, almost as much as there is in the U.S. It's some poor are pretty poor. And this is in rural areas where you're just like, we're totally disconnected. But the speed that's changed has been incredible. But I was stuck in a bit of an unfortunate time. The internet had just been invented when I was 7 years old by the military. They didn't have any application to be like, here's going to be unlimited knowledge. And that's the thing that I craved. I wanted to have a higher education. I wanted to have a classical education. I mean, the book that changed my fucking life, which I don't even know the name of this book. It was in tatters. It was in pieces. It was a biography of Leonardo da Vinci. And I read it endlessly. It was the only poster I had in my wall. I'm like, this is what I want to be. I want to be like Leonardo da Vinci. I want to be an awesome artist. I want to be an inventor. I want to be tons of things, you know, musician. This was that sort of spark. And I remember that any time achieving that goal, I mean, it's orgasmic. You just sort of, this is this ultimate goal that I've tried to set for myself. And once in a while, and when you feel like you're touching even just the tip of it with your fingers, that's what really fills you with purpose. You know, that's what kind of gets me. That's the thing that makes my heart race and say, I'm going to push myself. I'm going to keep trying to fucking get better. And, you know, feeding back into that negativity, where does that go? Well, I'm the kind of guy that goes to a museum and I look at artists and I see all their flaws. I want to see their flaws. I want to see every mistake in brushstroke. That's what I see. I see this flaw in everything, like the Marvel character Karnak from the Inhumans. His power is to be able to see the pressure point in anything and to destroy it. Kind of the same way with me. And then sometimes I've applied that with other human beings, which is where a bit of that darker side of my youth as a frustrated teenager, sexless and very unappealing to the female sex. And that developed a bit of that darkness, a bit of that anger that I had, because it goes from frustration as youth into a general kind of anger. But I tried to look at it and realize that I was an angry young man. It was frustrating, you know, middle child surrounded by women, very difficult for me to assert myself. Because my family's full of very powerful women, you know, with strong personalities. Conflicting against that will wear on anyone. Of course, the problem with that being that I'm so used to that world that now I wear on others. You know, I'm the one who's taxing on people. I could debate and talk forever. And that's just because that's just how it is. You either kept on talking or somebody else would interrupt you.
You monopolized the silence as much as you could.
Exactly, exactly.
Jacob, what I'm hearing from some of what you've already said on this interview is that you're a bit of a geek. The kinds of things you're attracted to, very much like me, are not the average jock type things. I don't see you sort of kickboxing. I sort of see you drawing and doing a little bit of academics and effectively your classic sort of intelligent geek type person who likes to live on the internet. Is that you? Are you that person?
It's much more complex than that. See, because here's the thing. Obviously, that's going to be the idea that people have. But there's another side of me. Like, for instance, with Ryan, we worked for years on his site called FightLinker.com, and that's for mixed martial arts. And the interest in martial arts goes back to when I was 12, and my best friend at the time, his name is Quay, he kind of got me into this whole Asian culture and the mythos of kung fu. Who doesn't watch a kung fu movie as a teenager and want to fucking do some kung fu, right? And I had the keys to China, man. I had a best friend who spoke perfect Chinese. He had been there for a little while. And his parents, who had come to a relatively small borough of Quebec, which is Sherbrooke, their desire was for him to make a white friend. They're like, if he makes a white friend, he will succeed in this country. So they loved me, you know, and our friendship was born out of a mutual love for both role-playing and video games. We'd talk a lot about those kinds of things. I still love those things, by the way. That's never changed. But that friendship sort of blossomed, and the influence of my friend Quay did affect my view of my own physicality, because I remember when I was 20, and by then I had not been very sporty. I hadn't done a lot of sports at all. And then I started to put on some serious weight once my metabolism slowed down, and I went to the Sears, and the mirror at the Sears and Robux is not kind. It shows you everything you don't want to see. And when I saw that, I resolved that I was going to do something about it. And my friend Quay, who by then had transitioned his love for martial arts into more of a love for physical training, he got me to do some physical training and get in shape. I was never Mr. Muscular guy. Part of it is also my genes. We're skinny, tall dudes. That's just how it's going to be, you know? Even when I put on weight, which is what's been happening recently, it looks weird because I'm a skinny guy with a gut. Be like, that looks all kinds of wrong. You know, I always thought the body that you inherit in your 30s is the one you get for your 40s and, more importantly, your 50s. And in today's world where it takes a lot longer to make it, there's so much more that you need to learn in order to be able to say, okay, now I'm ready for a career. It's like, oh, at 30, finally, I figured out what I should be doing. And that's a very common thing with a lot of people nowadays. And you just like, sort of 30 is the new 20.
I think there are a lot of people at 40 still working it out, you know. And I think that's what makes life exciting. Do we ever really work anything out? We're discovering ourselves all the time. You know, I'm certainly a very different human than I was 20 years ago. I'm sure you feel the same way, that there are elements of you that are like another human being from what you were, say, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, whatever it is.
I would punch my teenage self in the face, obnoxious know-it-all, know-nothing. And, you know, I've thought about this experiment. I wondered if this would be possible. If I could go back in time and try to tell my, say, 18 or 19-year-old self, be like, listen up, bro. If you don't clean up your act, you're going to spend the next 7 years without sex. So listen to my advice. And you know what? If I gave him advice, I don't think I'd listen. I think that even if older me with a picture of my fucking wife showed up, be like, just listen to what I have to tell you, I'd probably still be like, you don't know what you're talking about. That's why you can't time travel, because you can't change people's fucking minds. That's why. Not even your future self.
Yeah, even you can't change your own mind. Yeah, agreed. Just finishing off that question around geekness, because I'm still quite fascinated about some of your external interests. You said you were into role play and gaming, two things I'm hugely into myself. Are you currently playing anything that's caught your attention? Are you doing anything of interest in the geek world?
I've always wanted to write my own guide to Star Trek The Next Generation, because everybody knows that I've become kind of a research junkie in the last few years, just as a product of my job. But also what I do is I research shows, movies, endlessly. I want to know more and more facts. And there's a lot of stuff about Star Trek The Next Generation. The information is out there, but it's never been presented in a way that's kind of funny or can poke fun at the series. Like, I would take that thing that I normally do with religion and I would pretty much apply it to that. Because, I mean, you know, me and Carissa, we watch that show endlessly, and I have my own very cruel takes on the matter, but you know, that always comes from seeing the flaw in all things. I would only recommend it if you were brave enough to see the flaw and love the flaws the same way that I do, because otherwise, I'm a big ruiner. That's what I do. I mean, I go around ruining people's religion. That's what I do.
I would say that a good half of our audience at Primordial Soup are not just Star Trek fans, but belong to the local Star Trek chapter and wear the uniform at least once a week. I would say that's the level of following we have for Star Trek. So don't ruin it too much for them.
But like I said before, I mean, I would do things like talk about the behind the scenes. For instance, one of the episodes, Aquiel, which everyone admits is the worst show. What I love about that episode is the fact that originally it was written to be pretty much a ripoff of Basic Instinct. And then when they decided that that was a bad idea, they instead ripped off The Thing. That's what it is. So it would be basically a book filled with that kind of stuff.
And have you ever played Warhammer?
Warhammer's one thing I never really got into. Partially because people who are into Warhammer have no money. Like, because it all goes into Warhammer stuff. Yeah.
Yes.
I've seen it. The smart ones are the ones who go in there and make money. But as soon as that happens, it's like any economy. There has to be a shitload of losers in order for there to be winners. And there are fucking sharks in there. And I don't want to mess in those waters. Not at all. Not at all.
You are, however, a comic fan, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, that's where most of my artistic passion came from, comic books. I mean, originally, some of the very first things that I read, the reason I started to learn how to read even before I went to school, was in order for me to be able to follow what the hell was going on in these comic books.
And what were they? What were those first comics that you read?
The first comics were French and Belgium. So they were Asterix and Obelix, Spirou and Fantasio, Gaston Lagaffe, and one really fucked up called Philemon, which really tripped balls. It was like an acid trip of a comic. Go out there and research Philemon. The artwork itself is a giant LSD trip. And I didn't realize it at the time, but that had a huge fucking influence on my brain. Let me tell you what. In a scary way. So those were the very first artwork that I saw, was the Belgian-French school of art.
And what about superheroes? Who was your first role model superhero?
My attraction to comic books actually evolved. They went first from these French cartoons, because those were the ones that I was able to get my hands on. Keep in mind that this was the age of not plenty. You know, you're going to the library maybe once every 2 months or something like that. And otherwise, you've got to hope that your mom's friends have some kind of collection that you're there to raid the entire time she's there to chill out with her friends. And try to put in your mind, try to visualize the image so that when you went home, you could try to draw it. Because my time with these things were so limited, and I think actually it helped develop my visual memory. Like, it's usually strong enough that I can get away with not having to look at pictures when I draw stuff. I'll just look in my head if I've studied something enough. Partially comes from the limited amount of time I had with these comics. And as time went on, what happened was that one of my, I think it was my father's friend, he had a bunch of comics that he was getting rid of, but these were horror comics translated into French. But the artwork on these were really good. They were from Americans that had a strong Will Eisner style to them. It looked like Norman Rockwell style, but with just pencils. And I always really liked that. Yeah, there was like various stories about people being murdered or turned into wax statues and stuff like that. So that was a bit terrifying. But the artwork was worth it, just to look at all the details. And then eventually, That evolved into a love of John Romita Sr. and his Spider-Man drawings from the 1960s to 70s. When I started being able to afford a few comic books, I would always focus on the ones that had the strongest pencils. And I mean the cleanest lines. I love clean lines. I hate sort of like this messy shit where I'm just going to draw 10,000 lines and let your imagination do the rest. I'm like, fuck you. Come on. Put the effort in making the line. Show me that you know where it's supposed to go. I call it line understanding. Show me that you know how the finger is supposed to be split up into all the different joints. Show me that you're not missing one or two of these sections and have big fat fingers like a cartoon. You know, show me some fucking detail. And John Romita Sr., I always loved him, I mean, when he was really trying. And when he had somebody that could ink worth fucking a damn, you would just see the detail. And I just remember that so much of my childhood was spent either looking at a blank white sheet of paper or looking intensely at some of this artwork, scrutinizing every tiny line, and eventually leading to seeing the flaws. Being like, oh, somebody had that ink thing and then it went over, or that color's not right in the hair. And that's a different level now, because the magic of art, now you see through it. It's like when you start making movies. Then you see, here comes the blocking, and there's this probably where the boom mic is, and I see a shadow over there because they didn't do the lighting right. And in a lot of ways, people might say that ruins movies. Well, it just changes the experience altogether. And that's sort of like where I got with art, where in order for me to progress, I needed to see the flaws in those individuals that I looked up to, because you have to move beyond them. And the best way to do that is to see how they're full of shit.
And one last geek question. Do you play World of Warcraft or some such similar multi-online game?
You know, I did the World of Warcraft thing for a little while when it first came out, and I think it consumed about 3 months of my life. And after that, I kind of got bored, because truth be told, I've, you know, in terms of RPGs that has consumed most of my life, I would say it's Skyrim, because Skyrim does all the things well that I would do in a gaming world, which is basically, I'm a bow and arrow kind of dude. Always love the bow and arrow. If I had a large enough apartment to get a bow and arrow, I'd practice, because I just love it. It's cool.
Yeah.
It makes me feel ancestral. And, you know, I love sneaking and things like that. And I love a world where you can really lose yourself and immerse yourself. In World of Warcraft, it's too cartoony. I don't like that. I like gritty. I like realism. I like making choices, and I love above all else in all my games for them to be insanely hard, where every choice that you make feels agonizing, where did I make the right choice? That's what I love about games. You know that it comes to some kind of satisfying conclusion. All the things that you stressed about are really only to maximize your fun. They're not stressing about what are you going to fucking eat tomorrow.
So it sounds like you like to be stressed whether you're chilling or not.
Truth be told, you know what it is? I like to work within certain limitations. Like, for instance, if you should see my kitchen, most people would be baffled at what I can make out of severe limitation. Like, we're talking about two pots, a frying pan that simultaneously doubles as a cover for one of the pots. And from this, I create a huge variety of food. I mean, I even make my own fucking mayonnaise. Everything is from scratch, except for the stuff that takes way too much time. You know, that part, you're just like, okay, well, I'm willing to do a lot, but I'm not going to fucking lift the world here. But nevertheless, you know, in that kind of environment, I can thrive. Otherwise, you know what happens? Food gets wasted in my refrigerator. It just goes to waste. If I don't create that kind of limitation on myself, then all of it is wasted. So it's the weird thing about me is that I do thrive under those conditions. But at the same time, I don't want to invite them to the point where they stress me out. Like, you know what I mean? It's just, it's a fucking fine line.
Jacob, tell me about your podcast. You've called it The Good Atheist. Firstly, let's just start right there. Why did you call it The Good Atheist?
Now, truthfully, I picked it because it was the only name that sounded like it was good enough for you to remember. I mean, I had a variety of names that I was going to choose. At one point, it was going to be called Unchurch. That was the first name, because I thought, hey, I'm going to start an unorganization. This is very early stages, but I decided that that wasn't good. And besides, it had already been taken by a lot of religious organizations. Anybody who's actually starting an atheist site has probably realized that a number of atheist domains are actually owned by religious people who hold on to them so that we can't spread our fucking message.
Yep.
So one of the ones that was not taken, well, not taken is in it had been abandoned for years. The name The Good Atheist had been already taken. There was a YouTube. I think there's still a guy who has the YouTube channel for The Good Atheist. And I think he posts things once in a while. He must be in denial or something. Maybe he didn't get the memo. But, you know, I decided I'm just going to fucking take this name over. It is what I did. But Like I said before, I mean, I looked at names that had long been abandoned because I didn't want to compete too. I mean, it took me a year before I was even above the guy who had abandoned his blog years ago. I had to work my way up. I remember sort of like agonizing over the fact that, oh man, I'm producing all this content. When am I going to be featured up ahead of this guy? Well, you know, the one thing that you learn about the internet is it's a slow climb. That's all it is. You just have to be willing to climb the fucking hill. And every other little thing that you think is going to help, like, oh, I'm going to make a release a video and it's going to have a 10,000 hits and it's going to be 10,000 forever. Nope. You're going to get 10,000 hits and tomorrow you're going to get none.
Yeah, very much how it works. On The Good Atheist, what might seem interesting to folk out there listening is that the average passionate atheist is someone who has left the church and has a gripe with the church, right? Has a reason to be angry, has a reason to want to kick religion in the teeth. I'm one of those people. I have 13 years of good reason and regret to get off my chest. And that's why I have a podcast. What is your reason? What is it that of all the things you could be doing with your life, you've chosen to be the host of a show called The Good Atheist? Tell me how that came about.
When I was about 20, I think it was 25, I had a cushy job. And I mean cushy as in it was easy. I had secured my position in it so well that I could show up late, leave early, and everybody had to be cool with it because I was the only one who could run my department. And that's just how I just did things, because otherwise I'm like, the buck always stopped at my department. I was a shipping department for Interact machines. You can imagine when someone who doesn't have a machine that's helping them make money, how much they lose their fucking minds. You do a good job at that and you just pretty much have job security for as long as you want. And it was an easy job and I understood. They're tiny computers that are dumb. It's not the hardest thing to fucking get good at. And I remember I was looking for, I mean, I had always been looking for a greater cause. I think I was drawn to it. My father always had a bit of a hero complex, and I'm definitely sure he passed that on to me. But his desire was for me to look up to him as a hero, and I chose to look up to people like Charles Darwin or Leonardo da Vinci. And I think he took a little bit offense to that. And I'm like, you should not. You shouldn't try to compete against people who are also long dead. Because whatever impressions I have of them are just make-believe. They fill in any role that a father who, like any other father, is a flawed fucking human being. It doesn't always provide the things that you want. Doesn't necessarily respond well. I mean, like, my family was a divorce family. My mom and my father didn't really handle that part very well with each other. And instead of acting like adults, they chose to try to pit kids against one another. That was their big mistake. They really did regret it. We're all nice now that we admitted how we all kind of messed up. Once you move past that and you realize where they came from, you understand that, you know, I think that the disappointment comes always from the fact that nobody has the roles that they really sought out to. I know that my father's probably own frustration is the fact that I think he was always a better mom. Like that he had those instincts where he just wanted to take care. You know, he loved cooking. He loved making our lunches. And I'm like, that's... He was a nurturer, and I think that there was part of him during his childhood that they tried to beat that out of him, to be more tough, to go hunting and things like that. And my dad had to develop a bit of a cruelty towards animal that otherwise wouldn't exist. And I think that there's a tortured part of that existence where nurturing, he had to shut that down because maybe that even extended to, you know, other living creatures that he had to suddenly bury deep down. And how does that affect a human being who has to raise other living creatures? You know, being forced into that role, that's the real tragedy. And I think that that made him not really understand that there's that element. Like, I understand that in myself. I've kind of inherited that. You know, you can ask people that I know. I'm much more of a giver. Like, I do all the cooking and that kind of stuff. I like doing that. You know, I like showing up, impressing people, feeding them well. And even Chris right now, who's in bed, I just finished massaging her so she could go to bed because she's been training very hard. But, you know, I do that all the time. I like doing that. That pleases me. So I can only imagine that if I had been in my father's situation, forced to view that role as, oh, you're being a sissy or what other kinds of social pressures, it would have left my role incomplete because the other part of it is I don't think he was good at that particular role. You know, I'm like, I don't think you as the stern guy, I'm like, I don't think that you do that particularly well. But for me, the frustration and the passion, because you were asking, where does it come from if it doesn't come from religion? Because my parents didn't force anything on me. My dad may have had the same kind of vitriol against religion because he definitely got fucked over. But in me, because it wasn't forced onto me and it wasn't really a big deal, that's why for the most part, for most of my adulthood, It really didn't matter. But by 2005, I mean, I only got a computer when I was 21 years old and really started to get good at the internet. And I mean, I tried to have a web design business. People were like, I don't know if the internet's going to catch on.
Bubble burst.
The bubble did indeed burst with many of my dreams with it. Nevertheless, it was still relatively early where I started to understand enough of the internet to be able to do searches. And the internet began to be reliable enough in that content, because that's taken time too. I can actually learn more than I did before. And now there are tutorials and just about everything. Everybody can't help but teach something.
It seems to me that if I was you at the time, I would have gone, okay, here's this medium called the internet. And what am I all about? I'm about drawing and I'm about creativity. And it seems to me that that's where I would have gone if I was you, but you didn't. And so somewhere there is something about you that I'm not hearing here, which is what B got into your bonnet about religion.
I had originally tried to do other types of projects, but I had a really serious problem with committing to anything, of just getting it done. Like I could start. I mean, I always had a great energy for startups all the time. Just don't ask me to do anything that was long term, because that was my life up until then. And I remember that eventually Ryan's own project, FightLinker, when he was starting to get that off the ground, I decided that simultaneously I was going to start a project. Ryan is a grinder. Ryan takes on projects very rarely, but when he does, he finishes them. So I partnered up with him specifically because I hoped that that would rub off on me, that I would be able to gain some of his power and say, can I be consistent at something? And I remember that at the time, when I was about 17 or 18, I fell out of love with drawing. I stopped altogether. I was tired of it defining me as a person, because again, the goal wasn't to be an artist. The goal was to have artistic skill. The goal was Renaissance man. That was the real goal. And to have so many years of my life, like every year, the presents were the same. Here's a drawing pad that you don't need. Here's a bunch of cheap Chinese fucking pencils that break on you. Yeah, let me pick my own fucking art supplies, because none of you have any idea what the hell you're doing. And your superficial understanding of me is Jacob spends all day with his face buried in a drawing pad, because that's what I did for 13 years. And then I just, after one point, I'm like, okay, well, there's not a lot going on other than this. I'd like to just experience some other aspect of this trifecta that I want in life. A book was on the list. And of course, being opinionated, but not necessarily educated. You have a lot of different ideas about what you're going to write. I mean, the first book I wanted to write was actually about management. And like any uneducated person, I probably had a whole bunch of buzzwords that I would have put forward, and it would have been a terrible book, and I'm glad I never wrote it. The desire was still there, but I had failed English in my senior year. I had to take it in summer school. My spelling was that atrocious. It's improved over the years, and thank God I have a fucking editor now. It was definitely a weak point. It was so weak, in fact, that when I started doing the blogging, I realized that, look, the trifecta of skills that you have, talking is now getting pretty high up there. By then, I think it was probably the second best thing. Occasionally, I could write something good. So my thing is, well, I'm going to abandon the thing that I'm best at, because that's done for now. And now I need to bring up these other skills. And I decided, well, I'll use my voice, because the third skill, the writing, is going to take a long time to get people to be hooked on. And I think that I can differentiate myself from all the podcasts. And this is 2007. I don't know if you remember the State of Atheist podcast in 2007.
Well, I was very much an evangelical preacher in 2007. So the State of Atheist podcasts were not high on my radar, you know.
There you go. Well, you know what? Take a trip down memory lane. Try to go back and look at some old shows. I mean, this is still relatively early. It takes years to get good at your craft, like anything else. You don't go to the basketball court and suddenly slam dunk like Michael Jordan day one. That takes some time. And fucking a lot of time it took with the early shows. Woo! Those were particularly bad, a little bit dry. This is still when I wanted to be taken seriously. I never went to the classic academic route. I didn't go to university because I was never really good at institutional learning, and I definitely didn't want a giant debt that I would have to pay for a piece of paper that I'm not sure was to serve me any real purpose. What do you teach that I want to learn consistently and do? No one had that real answer.
Well, I have to say, your story could be mine, except for the fact that I went down this religious path and did a whole pile of trekking through Africa as a missionary. But the interests, the sort of progression, the language, the fact that I didn't go to university, the fact that I grew up in a poor home, I mean, our stories could almost be the same. I'm absolutely fascinated to hear how yours unfolded. But you're still not answering my question, Jacob. Religion. Speak to me about religion.
Why the religious reason? Actually, 2006, then I'll go back why before I started. 2006, and I watched Brian Fleming's documentary, The God Who Wasn't There. And I was also watching a shitload of Penn & Teller's bullshit. I think it was season 1 and 2, which I had memorized because I was still trying to do some web venture and I had taken drawing up again sporadically, but I could never maintain it for more than 2 weeks at a time. But by then I was like, well, maybe I'll do a webcomic. Webcomics seem to be picking up. So I'll try my hand at webcomics. And I'm not a webcomic dude. The joke format and three things. No, jokes either flow or they don't flow. Can't script them that way. But at one point when I was watching this documentary, I was a bit shocked, I suppose, that many of the things that I used to go around even saying that, oh yeah, no, I don't believe Jesus was a god because that's dumb. That sounds like something a Mesopotamian would say. But I'm sure he was a great teacher, blah, blah. Never really having read what he said or never really having thought about the actual intellectual consequences of these claims. Never really having thought of that. But eventually, when I watched the movie, it kind of made me really realize that I was just doing my part to spread disinformation. That's what I had done. And that disinformation, after I had watched that movie, I had read Sam Harris's The End of Faith. And his accusation, which I still fucking agree with, that people who do nothing, the individuals that are called moderates, they are just as responsible as the individuals who pull the strings. And you know what? Like, I've come to realize over the years, you see that in a lot of different ways too. It's in George Orwell's Don't Wait on the Proletariat, because they're not going to do jack shit, even if they're the vast majority. 60% of the people in this world will not do jack shit. They will remain neutral. I mean, it's even during the American Revolution. Most people just stayed neutral. That's just how it is. But 40% of people will not. And usually those will be divided into those two camps of people trying to push on either side. That is the distribution of people. And where you find yourself is very important because I'm like, I don't want to be the 60. I have no interest in being the 60. Some people, they might be fine with that. They might be like, hey, I'm happy just doing my job, just getting by, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, fine. But don't spread disinformation. Don't be stupid.
You don't want to be one of the 60. You want to take a side. So you picked a side. And obviously that was a side you were naturally on, but had never really thought about it in terms of waving a flag or anything else. But now you were ready to do something more.
Well, there was also a kind of sense of embarrassment of the past where I had bought into the JFK conspiracy theory. I had somewhat bought into the idea that there might be ghosts. I remember going ghost hunting in my teens.
So you're a little credulous about certain things.
Yeah, like I bought into the Shaolin monks and their fucking chi powers. I gave it a shot. But after I had done some real reading and I decided that the first person that I was going to trust in the information that I had was my own skepticism, my relentless need to make sure that I felt like I covered all my bases. If I asked myself, why do you think that? Where does that come from? And sometimes if you catch yourself being like, should I revise that belief? How long have I believed in some wrong things? And we have to all the time. Things are constantly changing. You know, like we just found out that the vomitorium is not really a thing where people would vomit. It just means an opening. It's just a really bad translation from Latin. It was a lazy scholar. How many fucking lazy scholars are there out there? Keep that in mind. The same could be said for so much. Like, remember the Easter Islands? I remember pictures of just their heads. Oh, their whole bodies? No one bothered to fucking dig it up and find out? Constantly having to revise information. Pluto's not a planet. Revising information. So it got to the point where if I was going to form opinions, I had to make sure that I didn't have any opinions that were ultimately embarrassing. I am still driven by the need to be right. And if you've ever met any of my friends, they fucking relish when I'm wrong. They love it because it doesn't always happen very often, or at least they can't always catch me doing it because I'll say things with such certainty when I say it that you would believe they're true, even when I'm not sure they're true.
You and I share that, yeah.
It's the qualities of leadership in a sense. You have no choice but to do that. You have to give people the sense of certainty amidst uncertainty because, again, the 60%, they don't need to be riled up and thrown into a fear panic, do they? They're the mob. They're scary.
Absolutely. So you started your show. When you started, way back, think back to your first podcast, if that's even possible, and give me your emotions. Like, what was going through your head? I'm about to put a show on. I'm going to push play. I'm going to upload it to the internet, and people are going to hear what I have to say about this issue of religion. What was going on there?
Here's what was going on. First, me and Ryan had agreed that we were going to start a business together and we were going to share the responsibilities of each other's podcasts. So what that meant for me was it meant that I had to commit now to a sport that until then, like I had basically spent 5 years totally not doing martial arts, did still physical training, but no martial arts. Now there's a new form, MMA, emerging back in 2007, where it really started to have that momentum. And Ryan needed a co-host and I needed a co-host because we wanted to cover all our bases. We're like, we're blogging, we're going to podcast. We thought we'd cast a wide net. That was our thought at the time. So when we first started, I wasn't quite sure how exactly it was going to go. But, you know, me and Ryan had had plenty of conversations back and forth. And we thought to ourselves, why don't we just record these conversations? Because they sort of sound like radio. I'm a monologuist. That's probably why it works out that way. But, you know, we started recording. And at first, I saw an opportunity for me to be taken seriously and to be respected, which is something that I didn't really have. Who was going to respect me? I had a job, but it was a nothing job. Right? I was still running a warehouse. And for a person with grandiose ideas and an ego to match, it's not very satisfactory. I wanted smart people to say, this motherfucker's smart. That's what I wanted. I mean, it's the obsession of all smart people. They want to be recognized for their intelligence. It's like a drug for them. It feels better than crack or sex when you get recognized. I don't think that people fully appreciate. I mean, it's like any one particular development in our human evolution where you have physical prowess is a development. It has a particular advantage in nature. And you look at our bodies and we're so adaptive. We swim, we jump, we can run for long distances as much as any other animal. And while we don't produce a lot of long sustained power, the short bursts of muscle power that we have is comparable with other animals. It's just that there is no specificity to us. It's just more of a broad general thing. All right, let's toss this highly dexterous animal out there. Let's give him an abnormally large head. For the ones that have the abnormally large head that try to pursue this, I'm going to be smart and that's how I'm differentiating myself. There's going to be a different range and there's going to be a strong evolutionary pull towards intelligence. So I'm like, imagine how strong of a pull that is. Now wrap up all that potential instinct and surround it with a shell of desire, and now you have the endeavor of science. It's orgasmic.
It's what drives science, doesn't it?
That's why we do it. I mean, we've been doing it for a long time. Even when you try to crush it, suppress it, other people are just finding stuff out, making notes, telling other people. I mean, that's our nature. And then other people like you and I, we gather information, re-spread it, compress it, filter through it, repackage it. You feel like a little ant gathering your little data pellets and moving them along. That's what I am. I'm part of the intelligence net. I maintain it like a spider, spreading it all over the place. Spreading my goo coming right out of my butt.
You do this for a living. Am I right?
That is correct. Yeah.
You are living off this. This is how you feed yourself.
That's also why I'm very clever about how I feed myself, because, you know, anybody who does this kind of thing has to realize that it is a huge financial gamble that I've been taking for a long time now. You know, there's moments where you just sort of like, well, am I successful? Am I not? It's hard to gauge because, you know, in many respects, what I do is really successful. And another aspect, a person could look at it and be like, well, it's not sustainable. Like, how is that worth it? Name me a business that is. You may be surprised, actually, how many shitty businesses there are out there that you think are really good, but they don't produce anything, they don't make a profit, and they're probably in the red. So my thought was this. I think that you can make a living doing this, and I think that there are plenty of ways that the internet can teach you how to do it. I've experimented with tons of stuff. I mean, I'm still, even now, I've been changing up my pitch. The DVD is part of that. I decided, well, now I produce so much content that my original pitch, which was $20 a year for an extra show a week, I decided that was no good. I thought that that was a dumb strategy because it was putting content behind a wall before it got listened to. I was punishing the people that would want to pay attention. I should reward those people with more shows, except for, say, if you want to have access to the high quality shows that I'm editing or the huge backlog. That's a different level of commitment. That's where I'm saying, hey, support me now. And it is the cheapest form of tithing you've ever fucking experienced in your life. The monthly one that I charge, $5. You know, I think that's pretty much the price of one of those Starbucks coffees. Pretty fucking sure. And I think that I do more good than a jittery hand or the onset of diabetes. I think my show is better than those things.
If I were to ask you at a philosophical level, at a level of the heart, what is your message? If you were about anything, if you were to raise any flag and wave it, what are you all about?
Even if I had 15 minutes, I don't think I would be able to condense enough of it. You have to understand that even in my eyes, good atheist, I see it as just one element of all these other things that I want to do. It's not the defining thing about me. It's just that it's one of the things where I can consistently do. And I want to just, especially with Bible stories, I kind of want to knock the thing out of the fucking park. The way that I look at my life is that there's a number of things I just have to do, like any other human being. I just want slam dunks. And I will not settle for anything but a fucking slam dunk. I took that approach with my wife, Carissa, and I've taken the approach in the book. I don't want something that's ordinary. Maybe that one thing that you do produce is the only thing that you do produce. Maybe I'm like that one writer who's just like, well, I did this book and I can't do another. But if I'm going to do that, I might as well make it fucking good. I don't want to phone it in. I have that constant desire, like any person who has this strive for heroism, of being remembered in some way. My bid for legacy would be huge if I had the given opportunity. Right now, I'm trying on a very small level. But the reason I think The Good Atheist is the best way for me to get there is because everything about what I do is honest on this show. There's no phoniness. I don't have to phone it in. I can be me. And if I can use that to elevate everything else I want to do, then it'll feel like what I did was fucking pure. It wasn't tainted by anything. Even if a fucking publisher came over to me tomorrow and offered a bunch of money, I would say no because I'm like, you're going to corrupt what the fuck I'm trying to make with your opinions that don't get what the fuck this is about. I'm like, I think I get the people who listen to the show. I think I understand them. That's why I'm just trying to give them more of what they want and what they love. I mean, I don't think a lot of other people are going to be able to do that. Even the folks that I brought in, like, for instance, my editor, Tammy, who does a great job, by the way, and she's going to be so happy to hear that. And I spent months grooming her, making sure that she read all the posts, understood what was the show about. Like, I don't want just someone who goes in and edits for mistakes. It's like, you have to understand, what is the voice? What is the feel? That's why every time I work in a project, I try to work with people who are fans of the show. Because you're going to want to work to make this thing good.
And they understand the personality of the show.
They do, yeah, exactly.
That internal vibe.
Yeah, when a person says, hey, when I sit down and I listen to you, I feel like I'm part of the conversation, even though I'm not. And whatever that feeling is of familiarity, maybe, I don't sound nervous like a lot of other people do. You ever notice when you listen to a podcast, a person sounds like they're just about to shit their pants? Yeah, this is why some people can't do it. Like, if you have any sign of nervousness in your voice, it's over. Don't want to hear you. Now I'm just feeling nervous for the both of us, and I just want this moment to be over.
Tell me about your book. You are putting together a book called Bible Stories. Has this been something that has been a long time coming? What birthed this book?
Like I said before, 2007, I'm like, I'm going to need to write a book. But 2007 to, say, 2010 or 11, saw a string of really great atheist books. And I felt like everything about atheism in terms of the argument had been said by then. And I'm like, well, I don't have anything new to contribute to the conversation. And I don't want to write the same book that everybody else out there is probably even currently writing. My opinion about this is unique. No, it's not. It's being shared by a lot of people. To have unique opinions is a lot of fucking work.
I know exactly how you feel, yeah.
Truth be told, most people's opinions out there, I'm like, it's not different enough for anyone to care.
A whole lot of people could have just written a book called Ditto.
Exactly. I did not want to write that book, so I had so many false starts. I have a Google Doc where I keep all of the stuff that I've, ever since the beginning, I've kept it on Google Docs, because I love the idea of cloud computing. I'm like, I'm down with that shit. I work on like 3 different computers at all time. I need cloud. Cloud is the fucking for me. So I've kept all of the false starts since I began. A paragraph there, 2 pages here. There are numerous false starts. There are so many, in fact, that I gave up trying to catalog them because I thought it would be funny to say, here's how many I did. And I'm like, I give up because it was so much work just actually trying to count them all that it was painful. It was a painful reminder. I'm like, I didn't have any creative ideas. Nothing that would sustain a book. Maybe a fucking pamphlet, sure. Maybe a great episode or a show, which many of them became eventually. But the book idea, all of that actually began 2009. It was on my birthday. And I decided that for my birthday show, I was going to compare myself to the biblical Jacob. What do we have in common? What don't we have in common? And I said, well, for instance, he liked cooking. When he tried to scam his brother, he was cooking lentils. He stayed in tents. That's kind of like me. And he hung out mostly with women. That sounds also a lot like me. Anyways, there was a lot of similarities there, let's just say. So it made for a fun show.
Did you also screw your brother over?
I don't have a brother. I only have 2 sisters. So that part, not so much. I wasn't Jacob the liar part or cheating my father-in-law. This is where we wildly diverged. I'm saying we had some similarities. We were both mama's boys.
Well, here's an important question. Did you wrestle with an angel?
No wrestling either, and I didn't sustain a prolonged injury. So I was not a wrestler. There are no real issues that I can tell you that I've ever really wrestled with. You know, like that moment that people say where I have a crisis of personality or something like that. They're like, I don't know who I am. I've never had that problem. One of my friends said that I was the most relentless individual he had ever met. And this is an anarcho-syndicalist who's saying that. Just a strong individual personality. And I am in many ways a bit of a lone wolf too. I do this because it's better that way. Otherwise, if a person's talking to me, I might say something inadvertently very mean when I'm just trying to be observant. It's like, I observe this strong flaw about you. How do you feel about me saying that out loud in front of everyone? How do you feel about that?
I can understand what people might feel. You clearly have quite an intense personality.
That would be one way to say it, yeah, described as intense. I always had to be assertive in what I said. And it turns out, I mean, you know this, that people have a kind of weird hypnosis when it comes to assertiveness. They like it. It feels reassuring. It's like a strong buzz deep down where you're like, ah, this person feels sure of something. I feel safer. I feel calmer. And with that kind of power, I mean, you know how it gets used most of the time. Like for me, the great irony is that I've been a fantastic preacher. But of course, who's going to believe in this nonsense? I thought to myself, you know, maybe there is a way to doing that unofficially. You can preach the hard truth. We only live in a world now where people are starting to accept it. That's what's amazing. And even trying to run with it and find beautiful elegance in what can often be just horribleness. You're just like, oh, look at that gamma ray burst. Wipe out life. Blammo.
Have you ever thought of stand-up comedy? That's a great secular preaching mechanism.
You know, a lot of people suggested it. My problem was always that when it came down to just trying to write the material, I was always better just letting things flow. I'm a good conversationalist, but not necessarily great with just scripted work. I did do a little bit of acting, but I never really liked it. What felt natural and true for me is just sit me in front of a microphone, and it seems to make sense to me. Just everything feels natural. I'm like, hey, I even like the sound of my voice. I'm like, what? Fucking 90% of the people out there. I find my own voice soothing. Yes, I'm a fan of my own voice, people.
And radio? Did you ever think of looking into radio?
I did do a college radio show shortly with a few friends, but I found that that environment was really stifling. I couldn't say what I wanted to say. And what I have to say is really controversial a lot of the time. It's so controversial. There's no mainstream TV or radio thing that would ever put what I have to say on. Never in a fucking million years. It's not even just my language. We can bleep that out. I don't talk just about offensive language. I talk about offensive things because you can't just ignore them. They should be in people's faces. And in a way, ignoring with it does not deal with it. You have to talk it out. That's the best way. And then you can kind of heal right after. That's called therapy.
If I were to ask you to just sum up one real highlight of your last few years of podcasting and one real low light.
All right. Well, I'll start with a low light. I had tried to quit Good Atheist, episode, I think, 155. I had just said, that's it, we're done. Essentially, I had come back with Carissa from Dominican Republic. We were in Montreal now. We were trying to look for a way to settle down. And I had been waiting on a job. And because of my relationship with the employer, I thought to myself, well, I can still balance Good Atheist stuff if I work with him. Because he would be open enough that I could still make decent cash and continue to do what I'm doing. But that deal fell apart. And at that point, looking at a financial black hole and realizing, well, Carissa's new in Montreal and she cannot just up and start her career here without making some headway, which just takes time. She's originally from Calgary, so I had displaced her and said, well, maybe we can make Montreal work. But Montreal was just not working. We couldn't find an apartment that was within our budget, and everybody was really paranoid. And I had just come back from doing the Reason Rally. And at this point, I wanted to give it one last shot. Here's an opportunity for me to go to Reason Rally and to hook up with some fans. They're going to be there, right? This is Reason Rally. If they listen to the show and I make a call out, they should come. So I make arrangements, and I have two people that I'm already supposed to meet there. One person, Ashley, who I'm staying with, and the other person, Lena, who's helping coordinate some of the stuff. And she had printed some flyers that I was going to distribute because I had printed a whole bunch, which was a way of advertising the site. So I was there to kind of promote Good Atheist and hoped that the people would come. But when I get there and we're waiting and nobody shows up. After when I came back, I mean, I was heartbroken, fucking heartbroken. At this point, I'm asking myself, like, I've been podcasting for 4.5, maybe 5 years, and I can't even get anybody to come out. I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? And this is right around the time where I'm thinking, okay, in order to save Good Atheist, what I have to do is I have to do the book. I have to do a pre-sale. I hadn't even started the cover by then, so I got nothing. I need to do this book. So it did a pretty fucking good job of crushing what had been that remaining amber. How am I even going to get $1,000 fucking dollars if nobody is showing up. I had spent a big chunk of monies from some people who were just trying to be like, you know, we know you're having a hard time and here's some cash and help boost it back up. So I thought if I go to Reason Rally, my thinking was that I would be able to weasel my way into it, meet with some people who knew, you know, like I'm going there. I don't know what to expect, but it might be one of the opportunities for me to network that I have not been pursuing and network with people that actually give a shit about the show. When I was in D.C., after the disappointment, what I did is instead I visited all of the American museums. I mean, I visited the crap out of them just because I wanted to soak in the sights. And that was a nice little thing that distracted me, let's just say, because otherwise I was pretty much like, yeah, I'm heading on a bus. And I was pretty much planning out how many more shows I was going to do before I was going to cancel. And then the day that I decided to do that, we're just in bed. And I think it was like the beginning of the month and we're just scraping by. That other job hadn't materialized. And now we were stuck living with my mom in a one-bedroom apartment. At that point, the thought of doing this thing was just like the furthest from my mind. But eventually, I think I reached an apex moment, particularly when I made those announcements. There was a bunch of people that messaged me pretty passionately about not doing that. In fact, my editor, when she started being my editor, specifically because she's like, you can't quit. I just found you. You cannot stop. I'll provide whatever help that I can provide. That was a big saving grace right there. And plus, I realized that I can't really work alone. Even though I do, I need other people there to believe in the project because oftentimes I won't. Oftentimes I'm just looking at it and being like, this is bullshit. This is crap. I don't want to make this thing. I don't want it to be out there because, you know, at this rate of looking back, I tend to be dissatisfied. I don't have a lot of my past artwork. Most of it has been destroyed, like not a lot of evidence of being crappy. And that's just how I liked it.
You need some of those optimists around who see the silver lining naturally and keep things motivated.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, while I'm still a fairly positive person, most of the time, I think I take a much harder view of what it is that I do make. I do agonize about the stuff that I put out there more than people realize. Oh, I'm an egomaniac. But with a strong ego comes the reverse. When you do something bad, you just don't think it stings more? Or if you don't have an ego, you're like, whatever. Well, that's all fine and good. But for those of us who give a shit, it fucking hurts. Egos come with their own fucking baggage. You take the good with the bad.
Absolutely. So you hit a down point, but obviously there was a turnaround. I'm hearing you say that there were some very important, some pivotal human beings in your life that gave you a bit of a boost and some encouragement, and you dusted off your feet and you moved on.
We moved back to Calgary, and that was also pretty tough because Carissa was doing a number of expensive but really crucial classes that she was going to take for stage performance and that kind of stuff. And when we moved to Calgary, we didn't have anything. We were sleeping on an air mattress for months. That's all we owned. And we didn't even own it. We borrowed it. So we had nothing. Obviously, at that point, this is when really we did receive some crucial monies. And it's at those dark moments, actually, when you do realize what it is that's good, where you're just like, oh, I just got a big helping hand from someone who's just like, don't give up, dude. Keep going. I remember in my mind, I had this daydream, and I call it slaying dragons, you know, because in my mind, I imagine myself in somewhat of a suit of armor and the challenges of my life. And these are challenges that are still self-imposed, self-publishing book. This is a challenge that I had decided that I was going to take. This dragon, looking at it and being like, how can I fucking slay this beast? Especially after I felt like I had just been punched and thrown on the ground harder than I did before. The financial reality of it cannot continue. The other big low punch was just noticing how much my membership had gone down over the previous years. It was just kind of like a stay down, right? It was like that final punch. But that was what I learned is actually the most critical one, because it's that one that really burns that's the test. All the other ones were just sort of like you knew you could get up from. But had you really gotten knocked out, like seriously knocked out? It's at that moment where I get that help from a friend who's also fairly famous. That helping hand was just sort of like a, hey, dude, get up. And I don't quite know how to describe it, but right when you get up from that, you'll have passion that you didn't even think that you still had. It was buried under all this other kind of shit that finally got knocked right out of you. And you saw yourself naked and you're like, I'm still standing. Now I'm going to slay this fucking bitch. And that's how I felt. And after that, I'm like, I'm going to do the book. So I launched the Kickstarter campaign. And in 30 days, we were at about 19,000. And it was looking like we were just about to hit 20. And then sure enough, like any dragon slaying, there was a bad moment where 24 hours before it was about to be funded, I find out that I have to cancel the payment. It can't go through. My American partner she was on benefits. And what would have happened is that even if the money would have just gone through her account, just passing right through, she would have lost her benefits. I had to shut that down. But by then, I had already spent some of the money because we were in a bit of a hole. So the money was spent. So all of a sudden, that's my dragon number two. So boom, you know, like nothing's easy. You should have been more careful on that one. Big fucking punch in the face. But again, because I had suffered that bigger one before, when I got that big solid knock right in the chin, there was no hesitation. An hour later, the thing was on Indiegogo. And 24 hours later, we were back up to 10,000. And that was everybody showing way more support, being like, dude, what the hell? And, you know, that created an animus in the people that had supported me. They supported me even more. And that's when you realize that you're on the right track because they see it too. They saw your fucking ass getting handed to you. And then they help carry you up because you can't do it alone, right? It is impossible.
Wow. That must have been an incredibly touching moment for you, just realizing you had this loyalty from friends and humans out there that wanted you to carry on doing what you were doing. I mean, that must have been wonderful, sort of one of those moments in life that you never forget, eh?
It's funny because I viewed the pre-sales as essentially most publishers give out an advance on a book. And I thought of it in my own way of saying, I am going to create my own advance. I'm going to leverage all of the people that have ever listened to my show. And I'm going to say, guys, do you really want to give me an advance so I can write this book for you guys, specifically for you, that I've tailored throughout the years? Because here's the thing. Obviously, there's always a mix of emotions. And for me, there was definitely the first part, which is like, this is amazing. But like anything else, I'm looking at it and being like, man, I'm going to lose 15% of the people that had been on Kickstarter because they just hate Indiegogo so much. So I saw the flaw in it too.
Jacob, tell me about the book. The Bible stories that I've heard on your podcast are very conversational, very from the hip, and just general discussion between you and one of your co-hosts around the story that happens to be there. Sometimes ludicrous, sometimes reasonable, sometimes serious. What are you doing in the book? Is the book literally transcribed from what you say, or have you written the book specifically? How does it work?
Basically, the Bible stories part are me flushing out the elements of the story because the process that I'm giving it is threefold. The first one is that I write the story very, very similar to the way it comes out in the Bible. I try to include as many details and be almost as literal, but even pointing out where something is obviously amiss. I'm trying to make sure that I point out how much God literally loves the smell of cooked blood. He loves that. I will use those elements when I'm writing it because I still want the story to be as faithful as possible. Like, I'm not going to just make up something in order to embellish the story. I don't think that's necessary. I want people, when they recount the book to their friends, that it's still just as accurate as any other translation. And after I finish the story part where I flush it out, the other thing too that I normally do is essentially the history of the books or the politics of how it was pieced together. Why is it that sometimes there seems to be this ongoing thread about how kings are bad, despite the fact that all the Jews want kings? Well, the Deuteronomists didn't like it because guess what? They're the priests. They don't really like kings, but they didn't want to try to change some of the fundamental aspects of the story. But it's always interesting to see the way that they just throw jibes in there. Oh, Samuel got a direct commandment about how shitty that was to have a king. Well, thanks for mentioning it. Well, we're having one anyways. So I think those parts are important, but also interesting. Like, the truth is, some of the story elements are definitely on the dull side. In the context of contemporary story nowadays, you might be like, well, this is totally dull. Like, for instance, the Book of Ruth might be to anybody else really dull, unless, of course, you start doing research about Levirate marriages. And you're just like, oh, that's interesting. And maybe it gives you an insight. I mean, I mentioned this in the book, that if you want to understand the relationship between Jewish mothers and sons, understand that they have no property rights unless they have at least one kid they control. So that tells you everything you need to know about the relationship between Jewish sons and mothers.
That is interesting, yeah.
So anyways, it's just tidbits like that. And one of the ways that I was able to actually raise a decent amount of money is because I'm using my artistic skills to illustrate people's faces in the chapter. So Genesis is actually a Chinese couple, so Adam and Eve are Chinese. So that should piss some people off.
Well, I mean, we keep portraying Jesus as a white Caucasian. So, I mean, that pisses off enough people anyway.
That's true. That's true. Especially when you can get a whole bunch of former black slaves to worship him. Wow. I still can't believe that cognitive dissonance there.
It's beyond imagining. Absolutely. When will this book be out and available for download and so forth?
The date that I had put was August 2013, although because of the Kickstarter Indiegogo thing, I'm still trying to make it for the August deadline, but that ate up another month. Essentially, I'm saying the Christmas of 2013 is when it's going to come out.
And did you take into account Copper Age prophecies about the end of the world to make sure that you squeezed it in there?
Well, actually, that's the Essentials DVD is going to be out, you know, for the end of the Earth. Because in part of the packages that I sold was the Essentials DVD. Because I thought to myself, you know, with 300 plus shows that I've done, it is impossible for anybody to just get a really good idea of what the hell the show is all about if you just listen to one. So I thought to myself, well, maybe I can just take the content and compress it and ameliorate it so it sounds better and present that. Be like, you want to get a good impression of what we're all about? Well, listen to the Essentials. That's why it's called the Essentials, not the best of, because in a sense, maybe all the shows aren't the best shows. They're still good shows, trust me. But I chose the shows that were more important to get a feel of everybody, like of the relationship between me and Krista. Like one of the podcasts is the very first podcast that we ever recorded together. Or there's another podcast when we were in Dominican Republic. So tracing our lives together through these podcasts, same with Ryan, same with Jeff. So I wanted everybody to kind of get a sense of who we are. And of course, you know, I include my favorites as well, like many of the Bible stories that people love will be in there. And a couple of, I don't know if you've ever listened to some of the Ask God segments that I used to do back in the day. They were quite sacrilegiously delicious.
I'm going to have to go back and download a couple of those. Tell me lastly about some of your co-hosts. We've heard Carissa's name mentioned. It's someone I've heard several times on your podcast. I know that you're engaged to her and I'm connected with you guys on Facebook. So I've seen your photos. She's a lovely looking lady and clearly into some sort of entertainment industry. What is it that she's all about and how long have you been together? And tell us the juicy gossip on your love life.
Well, it's funny because the people who have listened to the show for a very long time, if they had listened carefully enough, could trace the history of our relationship because it has been caught on tape, so to speak. Well, it started, she was actually a fan of the show. She loves podcasts. She's all about new media. She likes watching YouTube. I can't stand YouTube. I feel like an old man when I say that, but I prefer reading to watching videos. But she's very much, she loves that kind of media. And I was one of the podcasts that was on her list. And over the years, I track people when they leave comments and stuff like that. I take a look at them, be like, who are my fans? I love to get a good understanding. Who the fuck listens to the stuff that I produce? What are they like? And she was one of these people. And obviously, if you type in her name, Carissa Hendricks, in Google, I think you'll understand why I started internet stalking her. She has a great web presence and even better now. At the time, I thought, wow, this is my hottest fucking fan, right? This is part of the reason, small part. You go into this hoping for a little bit of fame because you're like, I'm going to meet somebody hot who thinks I'm a big deal, even though nobody else does. And so she got in touch with me first after I had posted a picture of her in panties, which I had called the atheist panties for the win. You know, she had underwear that said atheist and it was a sexy photo. So I put it up and it was pretty popular and people commented about it. And she got in touch with me and said that she wanted to start a podcast and she wanted to have some advice. Now, I, being the person that I am, a bit sleazy, was determined that I was going to use this opportunity to try to seduce her. And despite saying something as horribly cheesy as that, and obviously something else was at play that allowed us to work out a natural kind of chemistry, because when we first started talking, we were sending each other hundreds of emails. It was ridiculous. I couldn't work. I was paralyzed all day. We would just be sending messages. And she was just as obsessive. She'd be going to a gig and ignoring people around her, just texting the entire time. We were obsessive. And it was in the very early part of our relationship was us just sharing so many commonalities. It was scary. It was almost like we were of the same mind in so many respects that it was freaky. We had the same obsession with certain historical figures. And we're very, very similar in personality. We're very forceful, very alpha-ish kind of individuals, but, you know, very sweet and sensitive on the inside, which is a pretty common thing there when you have a big, loud exterior. So we met that way, and eventually, like, I'm a big chicken shit. I would have just stayed a fantasy online, and then that would have been it. But Carissa, being who she is, decided that she wanted to really find out if there was anything genuine about it. So she took a trip from Calgary to Montreal. That's 3,500 kilometers, not a small distance, to just see if there was any chemistry. And think about this. She did not really know me. She had no friends around. She took a gigantic risk. I would not recommend this risk to anybody else. But you know, as soon as we were together, we recorded a little video of us together for pretty much the first night. And it felt like we had been a couple for 10 years. We were even talking about things that were just freaking us out, like talking babies. And we're not the kinds of people to be talking babies. But we were in that exciting phase where everything that we shared together, just in terms of dreams and possibilities, we were both all about yes. We were just like, what do you want to do? And it was the first time that I'd really encountered someone who was just willing to just say yes to anything. And that put me in a very strange place because I'm not a natural risk taker. You know, even good atheist doing this full time, I thought is pretty obnoxious and ridiculous risk that I'm taking. But an added long distance relationship was the riskiest thing that I could possibly do at the time. We were together, but over the long distance, it became almost impossible. And because of that impossibility, for a while, we did break up. There was a period of time for people who would listen to the podcast where it was like, where's Carissa? Well, we weren't together then. But eventually we just couldn't stay apart from one another. And we decided that we would give it a real shot where before I think I still had a hesitation about ever moving out of Montreal or changing my life for another human being because it seemed terrifying. But when we decided on a common place, it was almost like a honeymoon. And it was just as insane as two people meeting and essentially marrying each other in how crazy and impulsive it was. But it worked out. That's the crazy thing about it. It just fucking worked out. And we were willing to work through all the things that we have fucked up in the past, all the ways that we just didn't realize that we shouldn't do this or shouldn't do that, or all the ways we had to change in a relationship. But, you know, I don't regret the risk at all. I just think that it was crazy. That's all. We were just so crazy. You know that tingling feeling you feel when you're loved? That's reason seeping out of you. That's what that is.
Well, that is a fantastic love story. I mean, you've spoken to us about a lot of hardships. I mean, really, your life has not been easy. That's what I'm hearing. You had it hard as a kid. You had it hard as an adult. You've certainly not had huge financial wherewithal. And your own personality in some way being sort of at odds with the world. But you found a soulmate and you connected, and it sounds fantastic. Really sounds like a movie ready to be made.
I would love to make a movie out of it one day if I had the gumption to actually write screenplays, because there is a lot more to it as well. I mean, I've never had normal friendships either. I mean, even my friendship with Ryan, my other co-host, it was not a normal thing for us, because when we went into business together, we had to share resources. It was like a married couple, except with no sex. Actually, no, I guess it's a married couple.
Yeah, it's exactly like a married couple.
I'm pretty sure that the people at the grocery store next door was convinced that we were a couple, 100% sure. And we never really wanted to clarify because we just thought it was hilarious.
Did you play it?
No, I never decided to overplay it. I just wanted to see if that was the impression, because I've always been really good at doing a lot with very little. So, you know, that meant that I did a lot of the cooking, even with Ryan, because that's how you save money. What you eat, what you put in your body, the price tag on food, it's a significant thing. And that's one of the few things you can actually have control over. Because rent and all that kind of stuff, I mean, it's pretty much the man holding you by the balls. But food is different. You can take $50 a week and you can just make something either amazing or have a whole bunch of crap dinner. But what you pay for is basically time and labor. A prepackaged meal is time and labor that you're basically paying for. Even bread that you buy is that. Because you could invest the time yourself, very little cost, and have fucking bread. I take the same view of mayonnaise. I make my own fucking mayonnaise because I don't want to pay $6 for egg and oil. I don't see that value. But again, like, that was the way that we were able to survive. Because the budget from doing this kind of thing, the monies that you make, it's a joke. I mean, it's tiny. The only thing that makes it worth it is the fact that your margins are just so ginormous. It's almost all profit, right? It's an electronic thing. As long as people can appreciate the fact that it has real value, I can infinitely replicate it and make money off of it. That's the hope. It's the internet, right? So you play a numbers game. Sure, it may not seem that great when you only have like a few hundred people that are paying attention. But you multiply that by 10, and all of a sudden, the few hundred dollars you make also gets multiplied. So the numbers game is really what makes the internet that fucking carrot that dangles at the end of your nose while you perpetually chase for it. And it takes a very long time. Even when you think you've actually climbed the hill and you're like, hey, I have a financial model that changes, what you don't realize is that it needs to constantly be changing, because what value you're producing might change over time. You're not selling a product in perpetuity most of the time. You're selling a very temporary product that needs to be constantly renewed. And that means your business is going to have to take the same approach. So it's a terrifying world of constant change. And that's why everybody else who tries to do it, they do it part-time. But I think doing it part-time, there's so much of the stuff that you don't do completely. You have to cut corners constantly. I mean, I'm sure you know this.
Absolutely, you do. I mean, I'm so aware of what it takes to put a podcast together. And I've sort of handed over the editing now, thank God, or somebody, that Owen's taken over my editing role, because I can now just chat away on a podcast and know that at some point in the next week or so, it's going to be uploaded. And if it was up to me, man, I think full time would be a fantastic way to do this. You could really dive in and give it your all. Do it properly. But somebody's going to need to pay you for that. And you have to, as you say, convince them that you have a product. I think you do have a product. And I think that you were talking about the adaptability of the internet. I think the folk like yourselves that are doing this full time have the greatest advantage in that adaptability. You're the guys that are the most practiced at using the mechanism. So if anyone's going to adapt effectively, you guys should have the plus one on the luck roll there.
The advantage, though, at least seems to be that if you develop an audience, they will remember you if they love your shit for enough time. You won't necessarily lose them, but there's so much attrition going on all the time. Like a classic thing is, if I take 2 days where I'm not constantly updating my Facebook fan page, is this a common example? The amount of likes will actually start going down. People unlike you. People get over you. Or you say something and you're just like, turns out that I don't like this person. Even just something as basic as trying to fucking grow a fan page is not one thing you're just like, oh, I did it and then I walk away. It's like cooking. You gotta have like 10 pots going on at the same time. And you're just hoping that one of these is having a positive influence, because ultimately, I said it's a numbers game, but there's another element to it. It's unspoken and it's not well understood. But what is the value of one click? Well, the answer is it depends on who the fucking click is from. That's an obvious answer, but that's not how the internet treats it. We treat it as in raw numbers, but raw numbers only increase the odds of that important person looking at it. It doesn't guarantee it.
Let me ask you a question. I'll take myself as an example. I'm a gamer, and there've been the odd time during my gaming career that I've decided, why not have the game pay for itself? And so I'll go out and import a few models or figurines or whatever it may be and resell it to the club. And the moment I get into the monetary part, the moment I turn it into a business, I lose passion for it as a hobby. And then I end up just going, oh, fuck this, and stopping all that and paying for the fucking shit and enjoying the hobby all over again. Is there any of that in what you're doing? Because I know if I was needing someone to click a like button, or if I was needing to see a certain hit rate on my site because it meant that I was going to have an income that month, it would be very different sitting down doing a podcast.
I mentioned before that I work well within limitations, and to some degree, you have to have something that keeps you hungry. I have lots of passion that I feel, like for instance, drawing is a hobby. I haven't decided to include it in the book, but trust me, it's a major pain in my ass, just only because to draw on the level that I'm trying to draw at, you have to work your way up to that. It's not like I pick up a pencil and all of a sudden I'm fucking drawing like Rodin here. It's not going to happen. It takes a day and a half of warming up before I'm able to do that. So you can imagine that if I stop for whatever reason, like for a week, because all of a sudden I got to work on a DVD, it's a pain in my ass. I have to fucking start it all over again. But to go back to your gaming analogy, imagine though that you were doing it for a living, but you had a shitload of fans who were constantly sending you praise. That would change things. And you know, for me, that is that motivator. I know that there's lots of people looking forward to it. I make some people's day, but I want to endlessly impress these people. I mean, that's why I spent 3 months on my fucking cover. I tried to have a conversation with Friendly Atheist because he's releasing a book, and he put up a contest, $200, and he's given like everybody 5 days to do a cover. And I'm like, what are you doing? What's wrong with you? $200, I spent twice that just for the coloring of my book. The amount of work and time you put into something will always show. And that's what people appreciate. You know that whole don't judge a book by its cover? Yeah, we say that because we do. I try to push this into people's minds, like take that extra time. It will matter in the end because you're trying to impress people. That's the way I view it. And when people are impressed and they say, wow, and that kind of shit, like they stick around. People like being impressed. And you know what? I like impressing them. I like having some fan out there who's like, man, his stuff is the bomb. I like that. When I did the book pre-sales, part of it was that I needed to have like a deadline to push me. Because in a lot of these cases, particularly with self-publishing, you can take however long you fucking want, right? And that's a huge part of the problem. You take forever. It never gets done. And I need the book to do well too when it comes out for sales. And judging by the pre-sales, my hope is that it will be really good. I'm also going to have to make a fucking big investment in there and shit my pants doing that because I'm a self-publisher. But, you know, I'm going on this whole, like, this is going to be good. There's that part that nips at my ass, but I think that's actually constructive because it forces me not to make bad decisions. The book was a financial decision. I had to write a book that I know would sell. And Bible Story sold because I had done all the research I needed to do from past shows that I experimented with content. I had lots of different book ideas, but this is the one that everybody just kept on talking about and remembered. That was the most important part. What did they remember? And if it sticks in a person's mind, then you found the formula. You look no further. If it has some kind of sticking power, you've done it. Now you just need to exploit it.
Well, Jacob, I wish you all the best, my brother. The internet is sometimes a lonely and ruthless environment to operate in, and you seem to be doing a bloody good job at it. And I'm loving your shows. I'm looking forward to your book, and I just hope you grow from strength to strength. I think you're doing a good job for the cause. I hope you don't pick up another flag anytime soon. I think this flag suits you well.
Well, I hope so. Otherwise, I mean, it would be dull if I didn't have a second moniker. But, you know, the only problem with having such a moniker is also that it sometimes is difficult talking to people about what you do. I've come to just say writer, podcaster, not because I'm ashamed of the fact that I'm an atheist, but because I know the kinds of conversations or the weird position it puts people in where they're like, I don't know how to deal with you now. If I was any other kind of atheist, it wouldn't matter. But I do this for a job. I'm like, if you talk to me about your belief, I will twist your will away. I will just bark at you and you won't even know what the hell hit you. And nobody needs that. That's not the way you fucking change minds. I'm just not even going to make that person's fucking belief even stronger if they start talking to me. So I don't do the deconversion part. That's not what my job is. My job is to give confidence, assuredness, certainty to fucking non-believers who are living in a believer's world.
Well, let me end with that question. What advice would you give to a new or recently converted skeptic or an atheist? Someone maybe sitting on the fence or someone who's just entered the realm of brand new, skeptically thinking human being. What would you tell that person?
I think the first thing that I would tell a person to do is, and this quote, it's always in my head, I can never stop thinking about it, is that you should always know your opponent's arguments better than he does in such a way that you could defend for him if he can't. That's the only way that you know that your arguments are well thought out, that you know exactly what his position is. And I think for a long time I had this opinion. I'm like, you know, I can have an opinion about this despite being mostly ignorant towards it because I'm being loud right now and that's cool. But that's not really a reason. I'm an opinionated person, but I have to admit that many of these opinions have not been formulated by me. They have been formulated by somebody else. I've absorbed them. I've assumed that they're true. And now I just regurgitate them. I think that's a natural part of the process. At first, what you'll do, because you know, you're used to that if you're religious or credulous, you're used to just kind of repeating what other people say. But eventually, either you get tired of repeating the same things, or two, when you start repeating it, you see the potential flaws in these arguments, or you recognize your own lack of understanding about one thing or another. You realize just how ignorant you are about certain things. That ignorance, that feeling is pretty important. It should be the constant motivator to not want to be in that position anymore. Because the amazing thing is the information is not only out there, but it's actually pretty easily accessible. If it was difficult, I'd have to quit. So the information is out there.
Agreed. I know about a great book that sums the Bible up quite well. It's coming out, I think, August 2013, called Bible Stories. That is a great book to read if you're wanting to sum up the Christian worldview.
Well, you know, there's a bunch of other books I have on my list of things I want to do once this project is over. Because the first Bible Stories will be the Old Testament. Because the New Testament is going to have to be written entirely differently from the first one. These are two different books anyways. And they have to be treated differently. I want the Jesus one to be a little bit more of a walk through history as we go through some of the chapters that are really repeating themselves. I'm going to take a different approach. And besides, I mean, there's 66 books in the entire thing. The book would be too thick. I got to stick with the Old Testament. But I mean, I've got the Old Testament. I got the New Testament I want to make. Hopefully the Old Testament one does well. I'll jump to the New Testament. But I also wanted to make a pocket guide for all the various sects of Christianity. Because I think that most of the time we're just like, what's the difference between Pentecostal, Seventh-day Adventist, fucking Quakers? There's a shitload of them. And it would be nice to have a kind of quick summary that maybe ties into, see this part if you want to understand where Calvinism comes from, Protestantism, and so on. on and so forth, and being able to make that connection. That's one thing that I wanted to make because it's not really out there. And
sorry, let me just clarify that. So you're talking about connecting the denominational concept with a particular part of the Bible, where Baptists get X, Y, and Z doctrine from within the Bible.
Well, there'll be that part, definitely, but there'll also be within it, for instance, some denominations or subsets of other groups. This is a subset of this religion, so see page whatever. You know, like in the old school where you don't have hyperlinking, because this is a book. I think that most people will pretend to know the minutiae of each group, but not really. And I think that pointing out their differences would be a really great way to crumble apart their whole ecumenism thing. Even some of them believe that they're similar as shit nowadays, because our confidence is making former enemies allies.
I'm intrigued by how little most people know about their very specific denomination. If you ask the average person, what are you? What kind of a believer are you? What is your name? What is your type? Are you a Baptist? Are you a Presbyterian? Are you a Quaker? What are you? And most of them either say, I don't like to be named. I don't like to be boxed. I kind of believe this or whatever. That's just them saying, I don't know what the hell I am. Or they have a very specific view. They say, I am this, but only because they've heard someone call them that. Have you ever seen the internet site Belief-O-Matic? It's a fantastic little site that you go through a questionnaire and you answer yes or no answers to a whole pile of questions. It's a battery of about 25 questions. And on each question, you also rate how vehemently or how strongly you feel about the answer that you've just given, the yes or no. And then it compiles all this thing, throws it through an algorithm, and rates you on how close you are to pretty much every religion in the world. So like your number one rating would be 96% correlation with a secular humanist, and you're an 87% correlation with universalist, and you know, whatever it may be. And I find that quite fascinating, because half the people I point to this site and say, go and do the test, come out, their first categorization is quite different to what they thought they were, you know.
Well, are these religious people or are these atheists?
Well, both. You know, I mean, I had a guy that thought he was a skeptical sort of atheist humanist. He came out as a universalist, and I wasn't surprised at all, because there was so much disconnect between so many different parts of his philosophy. And I've met folk who thought they were conservative Christians that turned out to be quite evangelical, and vice versa, and things like that, you know. People just don't really get it. They don't really get how these values and doctrines and facts all fit together. They really don't.
Well, I think part of the problem is that individuals don't really know themselves altogether that well. I think part of it is that problem that who we are can be fragmented, you know. You can be one type of person around one individual and completely different around someone else. So this idea that you have a very permanent personality, I think, messes with people's heads, especially when they have conflicting ideologies, huge cognitive dissonance. I think the great tragedy about it is that we have this overconfidence. That's what I think is the real problem. That we just feel, oh, I have a much better understanding about my moral actions. I have control over how I act around other people. All of this is hubris. You do not. You think that you do. You act as though you do, but that's the most dangerous thing about you. You are a walking emotional time bomb that thinks it's rational. That is disturbing. First off, let me not take myself too seriously. That's my first rule, really. If you take yourself too seriously, you frighten me. Like, if you can't laugh at yourself, take a step back and then see, after you've finished laughing at yourself, all the ways that you could potentially be totally and utterly wrong. How will you be viewed through the lens of history? Were you the one that just thought that the earth was flat? Is that how you're going to be judged? Because there's plenty of stupid things that we keep doing.
Well, 60% of humans, as we've already said, will not ever do that. And that is the tragedy.
And, you know, I would say even of the 40% that do, 30% of those people probably should not, because it's dangerous. And they get all crazy. I mean, there's plenty of crazy people that are very, very loud, and it's not easy to change these types of people's minds. They gave up a little bit too early on this introspection.
Jacob, it is now 12:17 a.m., and I'm going to bed. We've had a long conversation.
Well, before we go, I'd like to thank you for coming on the show. It was unfortunate that your interview didn't make it into the top five, but I hope that you saw that the caliber of people there was nothing to be ashamed of.
No, not at all. Not at all.
But it's good that you're going to be actually on the DVD. So in my permanent product, there's going to be a link to your site as well and some detailed notes. I do have a question for you before we go. I chose you because you had listened to the show in the past. And what's the worst thing about the show?
I'm nervous to tell you anything like that because of who you are. But if I were to give it anything, I would say that possibly you speak too much and listen too little.
Well, I definitely have noticed that, especially when I try to edit my shows and I'm like, shut up now.
I think there's just been the odd moment where I've noticed Carissa or whoever you have on your show will say something or be in the middle of saying something and you're just about interested in what she's going to say and you cut it off and continue with what you were saying and we're like, come back to that. We want that thought to be finished, you know?
All right, good. See, we started with the negative. Now say what is the most positive thing about the show?
The positive thing about the show, their tongues. The voice is fantastic. You really do have a soothing radio voice that is easy to listen to. And as you said before, it's conversational. It's fantastic to drive in your car and just feel like you're a fly on the wall. You're listening in on a conversation that you're almost part of. You feel like you almost had that chat, that you were in the room, that you were one of the party there. You do very well in bringing that sort of vibe off. Very good.
Well, I hope that by the time that people have finished, they're like, I had a conversation with Dion and Jake, and I found out more than I wanted to know about Jacob, but now I know the story. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, because there's still lots of stuff in the DVD itself. There's going to be the notes is kind of like a miniature book where I just cover all of the different subjects. What was the history of that subject? Tons of links. Imagine the notes that I normally put in when I actually bother to do a good job, but on crack. The 30 shows are going to be just stacked full of good stuff, and it's going to be even available. Like when people buy, they can go to the site, they'll be able to go and click on the links and that kind of stuff if they want to do it from the site. And I don't know if we'll have time to do an app version. I'd love to do that, but that is beyond me. That is beyond me. I've got dreams, but tough to get there.
Sounds good. Keep working at it, and good luck, my brother.
Thank you.
We'll be in touch another time.
Okay, with that, my name is Jacob Forte.
And I'm Dion Barnard.
Have a good atheist day, everybody.